We're beginning with the first aspect, picking up in the history of Judaism. And it was initially, it's a religion that today is part of a mixture of culture and religion. It was initially intended to be a monotheistic theocracy, the way that God had intended for it as it started out from the Mount Sinai, and it continued for hundreds of years through the periods of the Judges. It was a religion and a way of life. The people were to live in a particular way as God had dictated for them and told them in order to be a separate and holy people. And then they were also to look to Him for their rule and their guidance. And see that it was a religion that incorporated both aspects of religious and civil law. The religious aspect, there are the Ten Commandments, who had different sacrifices and tabernacle and temple worship that was incorporated in the religious aspects of Judaism. And then there's also the civil side of it, as we're familiar with, from the dietary restrictions that they had to the laws and criminality restrictions that were put on the people, how to deal with different crime, how to deal with disease and cleanliness in the lands as well. So incorporated both religious and then civil restrictions. So we'll touch on in a little bit later some of the later rabbis and teachers after the time of Christ counted out, and the common understanding is that there's about 613 commandments in the old law that's incorporated. 365 thou shalt not statements and 248 positive thou shalt statements. So the law is broken out by modern Judaism in different respects as to how it is to be interpreted and how it is to be lived by. But as we look around the world amongst us, many of the Jewish people today, there's a large segment of them that view it more as an ethnic background as opposed to a religious restrictions and religious following for themselves. It's more secularized, and a lot of these commandments are neglected in their everyday life. And that's going to break into what we're going to talk about at the end, into the different modern understandings of Judaism. The monarchical reign was instituted with the first king, that being Saul. According to Jewish tradition and the history that they've tried to lay out, Saul probably reigned between 884 and 882 BC. So he was very early into the history of it, and we understand the history behind Saul. And I want us for a second to consider some of the aspects of how he came into power, and then we'll be done with some of this, the far history of Israel. One of the things that the Talmud, the teachings of the Jewish rabbis, suppose that at the very beginning, there was an abundance of prophets. That's what in 1 Samuel you'll see, that there's many references to the seers of the land. They say that God had placed many prophets among the people to help them understand the law and to interpret it for them and answer any of the questions about the civil and religious laws that they had and that they were following. And then the people come to Samuel and request for themselves a king. And that's where we see the kings of Israel starting. Let's turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 17. And I want us to read a few of these aspects of it. Because God through Moses helped prepare the people for what was to come, and that they would understand what the kings among them were to be like. But in Deuteronomy chapter 17, beginning in verse 14, he says, "When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you, whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother." So we see this fulfilled over in 1 Samuel chapter 8. When the people came before Samuel, and after the time of the judges, there's been about a few hundred years has transpired from the time they entered into the land through the times of the judges to the time that they've now come to Samuel. And they say, The people said to Samuel, "Now set up for us a king to judge us like all the nations." That's from 1 Samuel chapter 8, then verse 6. And we see their motivation behind it. They had just gone through the time of the judges and the prophets, where the people were being led spiritually by the prophets of the land. They were those that they came to as judges. And then the judges also helped fight for them as the civil leaders to help decide civil matters between them, as we see in the case of Deborah and some of the others. And then we also see that they were the military leaders when that was needed too. But here the people say, "We want a king so that we can be like all the rest of the people." And that's an interesting aspect in the next verse, in verse 7, 1 Samuel chapter 8. And in verse 7, God replies and he says, "Listen to the voice of the people according to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you," speaking to Samuel, the judge and the prophet at the time, "but they have rejected me from reigning over them." Again, the intention was that the people were to be ruled by God, the law that he had provided for them, and this theocracy. But now the people are calling for a king, for a monarchy. They are wanting to change the way, and God has given them already an understanding of what the kings would be like for them. And that's the last part here in Deuteronomy chapter 17, beginning in verse 16. He tells them how the king is supposed to live and what type of an example he is supposed to be for the people. And this is where the distinction should be amongst the kings of Israel and the kings of the land around them. The kings of the land around them, the nations, were very prideful, self-centered. They viewed themselves as having an ability and a right to rule that was given to them by their birth, by their selection, and by their own understandings of deity at the time. Many of them did. But here they were to take one from among themselves who was going to be the king. And God, through Moses in Deuteronomy 17, beginning in verse 16, describes how he should live. He says, "But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, 'You shall not return that way again.' Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Also it shall be, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book, from the one before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, and that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children, in the midst of Israel." So we see what God had intended for the king to be, and how they were supposed to have lived. And yet, when we look at the history of the kings, how did they respond? How did most of them live? Saul was a proud person. He began to build an army, and he did not lead the way God intended for him to. David took many wives. He had many instances of faltering, exactly apart from what God had said the kings were to do. Solomon was one of the richest men, and the kings after him all sought after riches and property and power in the lands. So the kings of Israel led to great calamity for them because they did not live in the ways that God had directed for them and said that they ought to live as a good example to the people around them. Any questions on that aspect before we go into this next part? Anything on history before we leave history? Okay, let's go on to the next aspect about the development of modern Judaism. This is where we're going to see a lot of instances, and this picks up some of what was on the handout that Stan had started last week. So we're going to continue on with some of this aspect. Modern Judaism, after they have come through the various times of the Roman rule, we see that modern Judaism, as we see it in the world around us today, is the Jewish state of Israel is a democracy, not even a monarchy as they had once had, and is made up of more of an ethno-religious group consisting of Jews and converts to the religion. And we see it laid out here, the various religious characteristics. And what we want to pick up with more is in the New Testament times, as Stan has laid it out for us. During those New Testament times, During the late Greek and early Roman rule of Judah, there were four main sects of Judaism that developed. The first one, and a couple of these we're more familiar with than the others as we see them laid out in the New Testament for us, are the Sadducees. These, by and whole, were those who adopted the Greek culture, who embraced it and embraced the rulers more than the other people did. They saw we were under dominion of other people, and they embraced the culture around them in order to try to go along to get along, not to cause any problems with the rest. And the Sadducees, we see, were more rewarded during the time of Jesus. They were more frequently in power amongst the people, and they were chosen by the Roman rulers at that time as well for the high priest to be chosen from that people. During the time of Jesus, they also had control of the Sanhedrin Council, which was the civil and religious rule outside of the Roman rulers and the governors of the time of the Jewish people. The other group that we see are the Pharisees, and these were those who were more concerned with the religious aspects of the law, and they were considered a more conservative or orthodox religious group, and we have much familiarity with their interactions with Jesus, and we're going to take a look in a few moments about some of those interactions as well. The other group are the Essenes. These were those who were who adopted the idea of asceticism, which is an abstinence of secular indulgence. These were those who, in our modern thinkings, would be more like the monks of today. They separated themselves from the culture at large around about them. They tried to live separate, and they tried to live a very frugal, a cheap life that did not indulge in the worldliness around about them. They were very separate people and very devoted towards the writings. One of the things that we associate with them today, it's not 100% confirmed, but many historians associate the Dead Sea Scrolls to the group of the Essenes who had broken apart and lived out near the Dead Sea and copied the law. So those Dead Sea Scrolls that we are familiar with today from the historical aspect that recorded the Pentateuch and the Old Law, it is today assigned to the Essenes or attributed to their work. Then the fourth group that we see mentioned are the Zealots. They were those who actively fought against the Roman rule and the subjugation that the people were put under by the various world governments around them. They fought against the Greeks, and they developed towards the later side of the Greek era, and that's kind of how the Roman rule was brought into play. They invited the Romans in to help settle a dispute in a kind of a civil war amongst the Jews in Judea. The Roman government gladly sent an army over to subjugate the land to help the party, and then they took over and became the ruling party in the land. So we see those as the Zealots. One potential instance that we might be familiar with as well is a reference in Luke chapter 6 and in verse 15. One of the apostles is called Simon the Zealot. Whether that's in reference to his characteristics as a disciple of Jesus, or if it's in reference to his life prior to being a disciple of Christ, he was called Simon the Zealot in Luke chapter 6 and verse 15. So it's an interesting aspect where we see some of the history tied together. And then the next aspect we see is the more recent development of modern Judaism, and that's what came about around AD 70. What are we familiar with that happened in the year AD 70? Anybody? Destruction of the temple. Jerusalem had been sacked during an earlier rebellion. The Zealots and the Sadducees had started to rebel against the Roman rule. And in the mid-60s, the Romans sent an army in and began to assert their power more firmly in the city of Jerusalem and amongst the Jewish people. And many of them were sent out from the city of Jerusalem and were not allowed to come back in. And then in AD 70, they came in trying to put an end to the Jewish rebellions once and for all. And in AD 70, the destruction of the Second Temple took place in Jerusalem. And that's what starts to lead to the development of the more modern aspects of Judaism as we see it today. we see the four different groups that were the four common sects in the land during the time of the New Testament when it was written. And we see that their influence began to change around AD 70. The Zealots and the Sadducees began to rebel against the Roman rule, and eventually Jerusalem, they lost their power when the rebellions all failed, and they were kicked out. The Essenes began to withdraw themselves from the land. They again, that's about the time where the Dead Sea Scrolls are attributed, in the late hundreds. They began to separate themselves out to form these little monastic groups outside of Jerusalem to avoid a lot of the persecutions. And those who were left looking to claim the rest of the power were the Pharisees, that power vacuum that we see that had developed. And that's where we get the more familiar to us rabbinic Judaism that was beginning to develop. Many of the leading Pharisees dispersed when they were banned from Jerusalem, and they founded what in Hebrew or Yiddish, I'm not familiar enough with the language, yeshiva. These are the Jewish schools in different cities. A couple of those became more prominent than others, and a lot of the leading rabbis and teachers congregated to those. And kind of like what we saw when we talked about the development of the Catholic Church, there was two different power centers that began to develop. Some of the Jewish leaders went to one town, some went to another one near Babylonia. And these two different power centers began to develop, and the teachers began to write and to develop a way to try to codify what each group taught so they could then sit down, discuss, and decide who was more correct in their interpretation of what to do now that the temple had been destroyed. We see that for many years prior to this, back during the time of the Babylonians when the temple was destroyed beforehand, the people were eager and looking for a prophet to be among them. They were seeking the word of God to understand what to do during those 70 years of captivity. And God sent many prophets to them, telling them what was to come. And when the time of Nehemiah and Ezra came about, and the people were allowed to return to the land, there were more prophets among them who told them how to rebuild the temple and how to continue on with their way of life. Many of these rabbis and many from these leading Pharisees who had been dispersed were looking for something similar. One of the most prominent leaders at the time said, well, as we've seen in our history, following great destruction, there is great restoration that always comes from it. And he began to prophesy that a Messiah would be coming for them soon. And they were thinking perhaps within their generation. Again, this is because many of them wanted to neglect Christ and his influence as well. These were those who were unwilling to accept the Messiah that was sent to them. So over in Ezra chapter 6, that's the emphasis that I was just touching there. During that time, they had Haggai and Zechariah, who was encouraging them during the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem, the rebuilding of the temple. And then we see that after that, Malachi is the last prophet that came to them for 400 years. And Malachi told them, the next time a prophet comes to you, be prepared, for Elijah will come before the great day of the Lord. And that was what they were to be prepared for afterwards. And when Elijah or John the Baptist came, many of the people flocked to him and understood him. And then many of Jesus' followers came from that because they understood what the prophets had sent to them and spoken and were following and waiting and ready for it. But yet we see after those who had rejected Christ, they were still seeking something more, and nothing more was to be given to them. And that's where we get the more modern teachings of Judaism. Here's where they began to write down the oral traditions. Again, if you remember our discussions of the Catholic Church, a lot of what we see in the Catholic Church mimics what we see happening in the Jewish tradition during this time as well. They adhere back and they say that the Word of God, the Bible that they had, the Pentateuch, the Torah, the law, that was provided for them, and that is authoritative. Then they also began to say, well, without the temple, those things that were associated with it, and those commandments out of that 613, there were some of them that were very specific and could only be accomplished in temple or tabernacle observances. And now that they don't have a temple to go to, they can't offer the sacrifices like they were supposed to on a sanctified altar. They had no way to perform certain of those commandments. They say, well, what's next for us? And that's where they began to develop these oral or traditions. They say that, kind of, again, like the Catholic Church, that they claim that many of the traditions that they have in practice go back to some of these early Judaic traditions that were being practiced, and they say by the early church and the early Christians. They say that the oral traditions have just as much authority as the written word of God. And that's where these leading rabbis began to make claim. And they say without the temple to fulfill all of our commandments, we're going to rely more on the oral traditions. And that's where they began to write those down. The Talmud is a word that you're probably familiar with. That is the Hebrew for the oral law. That's what that's referring to. So in Jewish teachings, you've got the Torah, which is the written law, the Pentateuch, those first five books in particular. And then you have the Talmud, which is the oral law, which is, another word is Mishnah that you might hear, which they say was passed down from Moses at Sinai. So God had Moses write down a lot of the laws that they had been following for hundreds and hundreds of years, but then there's also these oral traditions that they were also to follow that they say were passed down from Moses for all of that time, but were never written down before now. Where does that sound familiar to us in our studying and understanding of the New Testament? Jesus attacked many of those traditions and said, this is not the authority to follow. So many times the Pharisees and the scribes and the Sadducees came to Jesus saying, well, what about this tradition that we follow? Your disciples don't follow these traditions that we recognize. And we see that this idea beginning to develop even during Jesus' time while the temple was still around. And yet here they are, they're saying those traditions are now authoritative and they write them down to form the Talmud. It is there to explain the legality and practice of the Torah. So in other words, it's more like a commentary on the old law and its reality. During this time, a lot of these rabbis, as they gathered together in the cities that were outside of Jerusalem, they began to discuss the old law, what they were to do, and they began to write and discuss and say, this is how you are supposed to interpret this commandment, this is how you should faithfully obey this commandment, and now this is the law to follow in order to be acceptable to that old law. Much of the rabbinic Jewish literature concerns are specifying what behavior is sanctioned by the law. And this body of interpretation is also called the halakha, which I think is an interesting aspect. In Hebrew, that means the way. So they're teaching you the way to follow the law that was given to them, and they call it the way. That if you follow their traditions, then you are following the way. And I think that's interesting again. How did Jesus portray himself? When being questioned again and again, he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Those who come to the Father must come through me. And yet, here they are, many of these Jewish people are referring back to their interpretations, their commentary on the old law, and they say, that is the way. So it's a stark contrast between what Jesus has taught and the traditions that they have carried on. Let's look over at least in Matthew chapter 15. And I want us to read this example of it to drive that point home for us. Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15, beginning in verse 1, says, Then the scribes and Pharisees who were from Jerusalem came to Jesus, saying, Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread. He answered and said to them, Why do you also transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition? For God commanded, saying, Honor your father and your mother, and he who curses father or mother, let him be put to death. But you say, whoever says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is a gift to God, then he need not honor his father or mother. Thus you have made the commandment of God of no effect by your tradition." And this continues on, and it says down in verse 12, "His disciples came to him and said, 'Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this saying?'" So when Jesus rebuffed them for their adherence to these traditions that have now become written down and codified in the Talmud, he says they were offended by it. And rightly as they ought to be, because as Jesus says, they made void the commandment of God in order to follow these traditions of theirs. Any questions before we move on from this aspect? Any comments?
Huh? Very short comment. We have a, I guess, I don't know, not parallel. We have the story in Mark in chapter 7. And I'll just read a little paragraph.
From Mark 7?
Yes. Okay. So it's on the same incident between the parents and the scribes. And Jesus said it this way in Mark. He goes, "Well, then Isaiah prophesies of you, hypocrites, as it is written, 'The people honors me with their lips, but in their heart is far from me. And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.'"
Absolutely. And that's the main thrust of that aspect of it, is this is what God had expected of them, and yet now their traditions have preempted that. Again, Matthew 19 is another one of those interesting aspects of it. We won't take time to read it, but there they're asking, is it lawful for us to do these things? They're questioning Jesus on the aspects of the law. Ian?
So let's remember what we're reading about this is, even though we see this, something that the Pharisees and the Sadducees did of holding tradition to be equal, not above the law, and we see, oh yeah, that's wrong, we don't do that, make sure that we aren't doing it. We deter ourselves at all times. We even stay within the falsism and other denominations. They do the very same thing, where they say, well, we've been doing this for years and years, not centuries, so we'll keep on doing it.
Right. It's that elevation of tradition into a now codified type of law, something that was warned against many times. Anything else? All right, so let's move on to the aspects of more of the present day Judaism. That's where they got their roots. Those who are practicing Jewish people today, that's the teachings that they follow from that we just talked about. It's the combination of the Talmud and the Torah and the commentaries that the rabbis have on them. And in present day Judaism, we see culturally it was spread around the world after 70 AD. And this is known as the dispersion. It's another word for dispersion. It's the Hebrew word for dispersion. So that's what's referred to after AD 70. The Jewish people had been banned from entering back into Jerusalem around AD 66 because of all the rebellions, and they began to spread around the world. And that's when the rabbinic teachers tried to hold the people together some type of culturally and around the common religion. That's why they began to try to codify it so that they would know how to worship apart from the temple as they spread about the world around them. So we see that being spread around the world around after AD 70. And the two groups that have survived and are the most common today are the Sephardim, which is Hebrew for Spanish, which those are those who had in more recent times were more populous over in Spain and in Portugal, and then the Ashkenazim, which is the German word. And we see that they had a huge population in Germany until, obviously, from our history, the Holocaust spread many of the Jewish people out of Europe, especially out of Germany. And now the majority live in North America and in Israel. And a few years ago, the majority of Jewish people have relocated themselves back to Israel. For a time, they were in North America predominantly by the millions. And now I believe the number is in excess of 6 million have gone back to the national state of Israel at this time. In modern Jewish ideas, we have a couple of different sects or denominations that have broken apart in the years. The more common aspect we see are the Orthodox and the Ultra-Orthodox. Those are the ones who try to hold very strictly to the Talmud and those traditions and to the written law. They find it very important to try to stay exactly within the law as they understand it to be. And as of 2001, that's awful small. As of 2001, Orthodox Jews and Jews affiliated with an Orthodox synagogue accounted for approximately 50% of both British Jews and 26.5% of Israeli Jews. So that's quite a few people. And the Orthodox Church, or the Orthodox Jewish understanding, is one of the most prominent aspects of it and throughout the rest of the world, and especially over in Israel. And then ones that we might be familiar with as well are the branch of the Hasidic Jews. Those are those kind of like the Essenes, who favored piety and a more simplistic type of life, but those who tried to live very strictly by the wording of the laws, and is a branch of the Orthodox Judaism that promotes spirituality through the popularization and internationalization of Jewish mysticism. And that's per the Hasidic Judaism aspect on Wikipedia. There's different aspects of it, but they try to be a very strict adherence to it. Those are the ones that you'll see that wear the long beards, wear the black clothing and the hats at all times, have the braids in various ways. So they try to stay very strict to it. And they are more of a compromise of the ultra-Orthodox Haredi and the other conservative groups, the more Orthodox groups of Judaism. The next group, The next group is the Reform, and that's even smaller. Okay. The other group is the Reform Judaism, and those who are the ones who have said that the Orthodox approach was driving, it was too difficult for them to follow. They thought that the old law should be more of a fluid, evolving kind of document. So they view the old law, the first five books, the Pentateuch, as more guidelines that should change and affect each of the cultures around them. This is a much more popular view in North America and in the British Isles. It's not quite as popular in the land of Israel, but there are a significant number among us. So I'd like to read some aspects, and this comes from one of the Reform Judaism sites, what they have to say about their teachings. It says the fundamental difference between Reform Judaism and Orthodox is the approach to Torah and the implications of that approach. The Orthodox believe that it comes directly from God and so cannot be changed. All we do is understand, they wouldn't even say interpret it, and the right to do so has devolved upon rabbis, descendants of the Pharisees, who probably began teaching during the Babylonian exile. The authentic understanding of the Torah is encapsulated in a word that means the way or the law. God is thus the lawgiver whose literal words must be obeyed, and from this comes the concept of mitzvah, which means commandment. For Reform, the Torah is the God-inspired attempt by Hebrews, Israelites, and Jews to understand their surroundings and their relationship with God. While it is a holy document, the Torah is rooted in the past, and we can even sometimes discern the circumstances under which certain sections were written down. Reform thus sees development in Judaism, not just through the biblical period, but thereafter as well, so that we can continue the process of helping Judaism evolve by coming to our own understandings. Anybody get the sense of what they're trying to say about it there? Okay. Say that again, Josh.
Subjective.
Exactly. They're trying to say that the old law was written for a particular time and a particular people, and it does come from God, but He leaves it up to us to interpret it however we see it fitting into the culture around us. That's why they say it's an evolving type of book and an evolving word to them. So it's it kind of follows the modernistic mindset that we see in the world around us and at large in the religious world, around us as well. It influences many aspects of religion, where people say the Word of God is not really something that has to be followed distinctly and directly, because it was more just a guide for certain people, and we are intended to take its principles, apply it to ourselves in certain ways, and what doesn't apply to our culture anymore can be left behind. All right. Any other questions on any of that? That's what I had on that side, and we'll conclude in just a couple of minutes. But any questions, comments beyond this? All right. Then going back to the handout that Stan had provided for us, there's just a couple of extra points that I'd like for us to touch on as he has presented it for us. Looking down on the right column, the modern, the M that you see towards the middle of the right column, he says, in modern Judaistic characteristics, the Jews are a persecuted people even in modern times. They're persecuted by Muslims and by the Nazis in recent history. They established the modern Jewish state of Israel in 1948, and the Israeli Jews self-identify as 55% traditional. That refers to the Orthodox beliefs, those who would fall under the Orthodox teachings, 20% secular, 17% religious Zionists, and 8% Haredi. In America, 22% of Jewish people claim no religion. Intermarriage rates are on the rise and further diluting the religious convictions. 32% of millennials identify as Jews only ethnically and culturally. Interestingly, Messianic Jews, those who believe Jesus Christ to be the Messiah, are considered both by Jews and Christians to be religiously Christian. Again, that would be very familiar with those in the first century, those who, have, after looking at the Law and the Prophets, said, Jesus is that Messiah that we had been waiting for. There are still people today who were willing to look at the information and to come to the same conclusions. A lot of what we've talked about tonight came from a man that I was listening to who teaches at a Bible college in Iowa, Emmaus, and he was a Messianic Jew. He doesn't like to refer to himself that way. He said he was raised in an Orthodox family, but after sitting down and finally actually studying after age 12, when he said many of them begin to separate themselves from synagogue life, that he came to had the same understanding that based on the evidence of the Old Testament, Jesus is that Messiah that had come for the people. Stan concludes, it says, it seems that those Jews who actively look for an as-yet unrealized messianic promise is statistically insignificant, though. Conclusion, Judaism is from God and fulfilled its purpose in preparing the world for the Messiah. And now that Jesus has come, God no longer considers it a legitimate religion to observe. And that's played out over in John chapter 4. I'd like for us to read that in our closing thoughts. John chapter 4, this is Jesus as he's sitting in the city of Samaria speaking to a woman who is out at the well drawing water. And in John chapter 4, beginning in verse 19, the woman said to him, Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain there in Samaria, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. Jesus said to her, Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know, and we know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship Him. God is spirit, and those who worship Him must worship in spirit and in truth. So we see that it had served its purpose at the time, but present-day Judaism is struggling to hold on to something that God had intended to be done away with. When we read the New Testament authors, we look at the books of Romans, the book of Galatians, the book of Hebrews, and we can see very clearly the relationship that people were to have to the law during that time and today as well. God intended for it to be done away with, to be fulfilled in the coming of Christ. All right. Any other questions or comments before dismiss? All right. If not, then I believe Stan said we're going to pick up next week in the idea or in the study of Islam. So that'll be next week. Thank you all very much.